Welcome, everyone. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham, and our guest is Pro Football Hall of Famer, member of the Dallas Cowboys Ring of Honor, and perhaps the most irrepressible personality in the history of the franchise, the playmaker, Michael Irvin. Thanks for sitting down with us.
Hey, man, thanks for thinking of me and this new venture that you're venturing in, Brad. I mean, you're the best. You're the best. And, you know, we had dinner on my birthday. I talked about that. You know, I appreciate you for bringing us all in the business. Every one of the Dallas Cowboys that are in the business have come by Brad Sham's hand. And I just appreciate that. I remember when we first started and we were doing arena football together.
Yes.
And you said to me, well, we first had the discussion about what we were wearing on air. You remember that?
Yes. Michael came in. We were in rough. Wait, I just want to listen to that laugh for a minute, so we're going to talk about that a little bit. Michael was working for Fox Television, and the first year of the Dallas Desperados, I was doing the play-by-play of the telecast. Michael is the analyst. Michael flies in from Los Angeles. We're having a meeting in Raleigh, North Carolina, because we're doing a game that night. Michael comes in. Meeting's been going on. He's just flown all night, and he sat down, and I said, Mike, we're wearing golf shirts tonight. And Michael said, golf shirts? I don't have any golf shirt pants.
I had never wore really golf shirts.
And I said, Michael, do you have a pair of pants?
Pair of pants.
Yeah. Then you got golf shirt pants.
Yeah, it was a golf shirt pants. And that was so funny, man. And Brad said, listen, man, you won't be in it forever. You just got to dip your toe and give it all you got. And trust me, it's going to work as you move on and do other things. Just give it to me. So, Brad, I just appreciate all of it, man. I appreciate, you know, you being the voice of the Cowboys for so long and then sharing that voice with so many of us personally and helping us transition into new worlds.
The pleasure and the honor are really mine, and you've started exactly where I wanted to start. Sometimes on these then and now conversations, I start with then. But right now, I want to start with now, because the reason you were gracious enough to share your birthday dinner with me was the fact that it was a significant number for you. 52 doesn't sound like much to some
backwards.
People.
I like to say 25 backwards.
You can do that for a year.
Just 25.
do that for a year, and then we'll be on to something else. But the reason 52 was an important one for you was that your father only lived to be 51. And that had been on your mind for years. Tell people about that.
Forever, and it's so amazing.
And how old were you when he passed?
Oh, I was going into my senior year in high school.
Okay.
And so I was my junior year off season, because I didn't play football. I didn't play any sport at all in my junior year because I transferred from a public school to a private school. And, of course, the public school thought I was recruited and said I didn't have enough of wherewithal to make a decision strictly for academic reasons. So they took me to court. And in a court case, that was the ruling that came down from the judge that I couldn't play sports. And my dad was real proud of me for making the decision because St. Thomas was a college prep school and I was trying to get myself situated to get into college. And when we lost the court case, and this ruling came down that I could stay at St. Thomas and if it was about the education and get that education, but I was not allowed to play sports. And if I went back to my public school, then they would allow me to play sports. I made the decision, and it was a tough decision not to play, but to try to pull myself up academically to get prepared for college. And my father was so proud of me. And, you know, so we didn't play that year, and I was waiting to show him my senior year. And he passed a few days before that first game.
Why did you make that decision?
Oh, God, Brad, it was, you know, I'm the 15th of 17 kids, and that whole group, my oldest brother is the only one that went to college. And he's the second of the 17. So that's a big span that didn't go to college. for a long time. Just didn't get it. And I was like, man, I don't want to be that. You know, I didn't want to be that. So I said, I got to do some things. I got to make some changes. And I made a decision to try to get to a better place, to get from around some of the people that I was going to school with. They were just lost. They didn't have direction. Man, when I got to St. Thomas, oh my God, just to be around those kids who had plans. This is what I'm doing. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to go into this, because most of them families own companies or own corporations and organizations all over. But so they had a plan. That's the first time I said, oh, my God, I have to get a plan. This is what it is. I have to get a plan. So that's when the ruling came down about staying, not playing sports. I was like, OK, this is part of my plan. I need the year anyway to catch up. And they gave me a great tutor. My English teacher, her daughter was my tutor, Jen Jones, who is just a great, great girl, and really helped me get through that first year and get acclimated and get caught up and everything. But I wanted to go to college. I did not want to have my whole life living the way we were living and where we come from, spending my time raising my family.
Your dad was a roofer.
A roofer and a pastor. He's a roofer. All week, and then all week, I mean, I'm talking about work from sun up to sun down. I'm talking about sun up to sun down in the heat of Florida, putting roofs on, putting tile on roofs. And then on Friday evenings, after you get off work, they all pile in a car. And he drives to Georgia, the pastor of church, and drives back Sunday after church. And right back up Monday morning. It was incredible to watch.
And how old were you the summer that you worked with him? I remember you telling me there was one summer you worked with him, and you said, mm-mm.
Well, my dad used to always tell me, he's an interesting man, and he said things in different ways. He said, son, you know, as a man, it's about decisions and consequences. I thought, that's a fascinating statement to come from my father when I look back over my life and some of the decisions and consequences I've had to deal with. But he always said, he says, being a man is about decisions and consequences. He said, you can make a decision. You can make a decision, but you got to be willing and to handle the consequences that come with that decision. And you know, so yeah. And he said, you can make a decision. I said, well, so I can make a decision not go to school? He said, yeah, you don't go to school, man. I understand. You don't have to go to school. I said, oh, that's the decision I'm making. I'm done with school. And I was young. Maybe I was fourth, fifth grade at this time. You know, sixth grade at this time. I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm done. I'm sitting here. I'm chilling. The next morning, about 6 in the morning, hey, get up. I said, what's up, Dad? I said, listen, no. Remember, I made a decision that I'm not going to school. I'm done with school. He said, yeah, that was the decision. Now, the consequences, you got to go to work with me. I said, he said, get up. Let's get ready. I said, okay, there's no problem. I can do that. You know, make some money. Whoo, I went out there. Man, one day. And my job was to make the mud, because you got the thing in the bottom. You got to make the mud. They roll it and turn it, put the cement in there, put the sand in, put the water, crank it out, and then pour it in the tank at the bottom. I got to shovel it out in buckets, carry the buckets up under the ladder, stack them up under the ladder, hook it on a pulley, and pull it up on top of the roof.
You're like 10 years old.
Yeah. I'm 10, 11, 12 years old at the time. I'm pulling. I mean, we did this from 7 in the morning till sundown to 7 at night. And I was like, oh, my God. I went home. I was so tired.
One day.
I was totally, totally covered in cement when I got home, clothes, cement. Man, the next morning, he came to tap me by 6. I said, whew. I said, oh, look, Dad, I made another decision. He said, what's that? I'm going back to school. It was the hardest thing in the world. To this day, Brad, I took those pants. And he would still make me go. He would make me go in the summer, and I would take the clothes from that, and I took them to college with me. And they that is what was on my wall in college. Because I told myself, you better make it at this or you got to go back and do that. And I was not going back doing that.
I remember you saying once that after you'd become a professional success in football, that the thing that motivated you was fear.
Yeah.
And that the you weren't afraid of the other team, although when Jerome Brown, God rest his soul, was on the Eagles, yeah, there once or twice you said you were a little bit afraid of him.
I knew JB, but I wasn't the only one afraid of
him. No. But what you said was that experience working for your dad, and if you weren't focused, you didn't get anything to eat when you were one of 17. That was the fear of how am I going to sustain myself to the next day is what motivated you all your life?
All my life and past and even now, you know, even now it's amazing. The fear that you allow to come into your world. We talked about it earlier when we talked about the 51. And for some reason, I just thought, 51, man, after all my dad did, I worked hard, 51's going to be my year. We talked about it, and that's why we had that big celebratory moment at the age of 52, you know, because, boy, okay. So now I start to say, why did I waste so much time on fear with that? How did I let that, I put so much brain equity on it, and it did not happen, you know. Thank God it didn't happen, but it did not happen. But absolutely, fear. Fear is a great motivator. I want my family to have a better life than my family had then. I want my family now to have a better life, and I want to be able to help the family that grew up with me then have a better life also. And all of that is fear motivated.
That's a lot of responsibility when your parents are both gone. Yeah. All of those siblings, the public, visible success that you have had. That's a lot of responsibility to take care of all those people and maintain any kind of integrity, isn't it?
It is a lot. And to be honest with you, Brad, whatever you're dealing with a lot of people, it's a lot. Because, you know, family, it's a lot. Everyone that has family is dealing with a lot of responsibility. It is, you know, and God is so great and smart. That's why he told you, we call in this family. You guys are blood related. You don't have the choice of love. You got to love. Because he knew if he gave you the choice of love, what? With family? You know what I mean? He was like, oh, God, we can't give you the choice of love with family. You just got to love family. Because family takes you through a lot of stuff, man. I promise you. I bet you. I would have been better off buying a car lot. Because I bought a car lot. You know what I mean? I would have been better off buying a car lot.
You might have sold one to somebody else and made a dollar.
Sold one, give one away. Sell one, give one away. I would have broke even. I wouldn't have made any money with it. But I would have saved some money from all the money I spent from the car lot that I had to buy for everybody else. And the issue is, with family, it never stops. It never stops. Ever
That's kind of where I was going.
It never stops. It keeps going, and it's going now. But it changes. Like now.
Now you have children.
Right. And I have children. And my sisters and brothers have children. So I try to tell them, I say, here's the distinguishing difference. When I give to you, my sisters and brothers, I'm spending money. It's a waste of money. I get no return on it. You guys are old. But when I spend with your kids, my nieces and nephews, I see that as an investment. I said, now understand, all the money that I have for you, I don't have anymore. It goes to your kids. That's what it is. You know, so I try to put my nieces and nephews in great schools. I get to get them at St. Thomas and places like that, and I help and pay for them. Because that's the way I feel. I can get them all off the payroll. It's not, you know, if I get the kids and help them get better education so they get better jobs, then they get off the payroll.
And then their parents are their problem.
And then, right. Then I can turn the parents over to them. Yeah. That's exactly the plan.
I actually do have some football things I want to talk about, but I've had conversations with you before, and I know that if things tend to get going, and if I don't get a question or two in that I want to ask, we may not get back there. So you said yourself how interesting it was that considering your life, that your father said decisions and consequences.
Right.
How have you reconciled the way trouble has followed you?
Yeah. Right. There are a number of ways, man. I've always, you know, my mom said at an early age, she said, baby, God bless her. She's been bad in a thousand. I mean, she said, baby, you know, God has his hand on you. She would tell me, she said, you know, when I was pregnant with you, you know, I was crying in church because like we just couldn't afford another child. We just couldn't afford it. And she said, God put his arms around her womb and said, Pearl, this will be the one that shall bless you. He will make your latter days. I'll never forget her exact words. And that's all she would always say to me. He will make your latter days better than your former days, you know. And so every day when she would carry me and we walked by our refrigerator, she opened up, there's nothing in there. I was just a baby. And she would say, that's okay, baby. As long as I got you, God promised me my latter days are going to be better than my former days. I remember that. It just plays over and over.
You remember hearing that as an infant?
Oh, my God, I remember that. It sticks with me. My latter days will be better than my former days, baby. God told me that. And she would always tell me, even as a kid growing up, she said, you know, God ain't going to let you get away with nothing. He's not. He said, baby, he's going to keep you on a tight leash, and he'll yank your chain. Now, he's going to cover you. And because he has need of you, but he's not going to let you get away with nothing. And I would, you know, we were kids. We would be out throwing rocks, just throwing rocks, messing around. And you'll hear one, cling, 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 cling. And who in the house? They come knock right on my house. And she would look at me, baby, we've talked about this already, you know. So it was groomed in me at an early stage there about, you know, this is what it is. You're not getting away with anything. You're going to deal with the decision, with the consequences of all your decisions and how you handle them. Now, how I try to deal with it now is try to understand, you know, in the reality as I go through and I go to service every Sunday and I read the Bible, every person in the Bible has had struggles. And they are known by the struggles that they've had and the things that they've overcome. And we go back to a book written thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago to get encouragement, motivation, and inspiration today. People learn from people that have gone through the peaks and valleys of life. They don't tend to learn as much from the people that they pretend to have the perfect life, because in reality, we are all going through the peaks and valleys of life. So we gravitate towards that. And I try to say that, God, I went through some of those things. I've come through a lot of those things, and he's done it for purpose, for other things that we got to do and other people that we have to reach. I have to put a forward spin on it, and I have to move forward, or you'll sit and just go crazy in regret of some of the decisions you made.
Do you ever say, Lord, I think I've showed you that I've learned some things. Could I have 1 year without any stuff?
Yeah.
and then we can even talk about what you want down the road. Can I just have one year?
I don't know if you ever have. Well, 1 year without any stuff is impossible for anybody.
You know what I mean.
But 1 year without any mess.
Okay.
What we're always
it's just language,
for.
Sure.
And what we're looking for, honestly, we're all trying to just stack messless years together. I'll call them that.
Perfect.
Messless years together. Let me just put 10 together. You know, just give me 1 year, give me 2 years, give me 3 years. But yeah, and what we are now, and the way things are now, you know, and what we're talking about, right? There's a great fear in life. It's just a great fear about it because you don't know anybody and anything. And I try to say, do the right thing, be good to people and all of those things, and everything will work out. That's the best you can do at this stage. But obviously, the vicissitudes of life still touch me. They still touch me, and I still have to deal with them. And sometimes they're hard, but you just got to get back up and keep moving.
All right, now watch what I'm going to do here. A lot of what we're talking about is perception against reality.
Yeah.
You can walk through an airport all by yourself and there are people looking at you, recognize you, and think you're up to something because you're Michael Irvin, right?
Yeah, that's what it is.
The first perception a lot of us had of you was in an orange 47 jersey. And for a lot of people, a look at that kid running around in 47, they thought three things. One, that guy is really a good football player. Two, I wish he was on my team. Three, if he's not on my team, I'll bet he's an enormous pain. An enormous pain. And I don't think I like him very much. That's from the beginning.
Yeah.
And that didn't change much when the shirt turned white and the number turned to 88. Where do you suppose that early perception of you as a player came from?
I think perceptions are a lot of times, and Bishop, it's so funny, Bishop preached about this a couple of weeks ago. He says how people perceptions becomes your prison. You know, and you there could be people you don't know, and you're around someone, and they know that person, and they just, I don't know, I just don't like that guy right there. He just seems always like he's stuck up. Now, that's his opinion. But now every time you see that guy, that's what you think. Oh, you know. So if the guy's tired and he gets off the plane and he doesn't say anything to anybody, so I'll look at him. He's stuck up. You've already formulated your opinion off another person's perception of that person. You know, the reality is everyone won't get a chance to touch you. So you have to have an ability to move past perceptions and understand your reality, because everybody's going to have a perception and everybody won't get a chance to touch you personally. And I would like to think, you know, that everyone hopes and wants what's best for everyone. That's the world we pretend to be in, but that's not the world we're really in. There's a reason everybody stops and slows down when there's an accident on the side of the road. You know why? Because they're leaving a miserable job, probably headed to a miserable home, and they just want that moment to say, oh, at least I'm not that guy, and we stop. You see what I'm saying? This is the world that we are in. And you have to say, hey, I understand. I know who I am. And try to be right and be good with people and keep it moving. That's all you can do.
All right, let's get you to the NFL. One of the things that really was interesting to me about the Cowboys pre-89 was the understanding, the perception, but I think it was pretty close to reality, that when the Cowboys drafted players, and that was how you acquired players in those days, Tom Landry got the first one. And Gil Brandt got the next few. And they'd give Tex Schramm a little crumb at the end of the 17-round draft. He could draft Roger Staubach or Chad Hennings or Bob Hayes or Carl Lewis. And he did all those things. You and Tom Landry sounds like the biggest mismatch since David and Goliath. Right?
Yes.
Tell me about that. First meeting. And a lot of us, by the way, remember Michael running up to a big cardboard cutout of Tom Landry after he was drafted and hugging him, and it was the caption was, "My new papa."
Yeah.
What was that like, you and Tom Landry?
And I don't think people understand the depth of me calling him my new papa at the time. You know, my dad was a huge Cowboy fan. And he always said, you know, when I first started playing ball, I said, "You'll play for the Cowboys one day." It's the only game, the only team we really
You're
watched.
In Florida.
Yeah, I'm in Florida. But he's huge. He wore the fedora hat. He wore Tom Landry's hat all the time. If I showed you a picture, you'll see him with that hat on. I mean, he loved the hat. He wore the hat. And we sat and we watched all the time the Dallas Cowboys. And he said, "Yeah, you're going to play for the Cowboys one day. Boy, I can't wait to see you play for the Cowboys one day." You know, when I first started playing, and I was like, wow, that's incredible. And we would sit and watch. He would promise me, "One day, son, I'm going to take you to a game. One day, I'm going to take you to a game." We could never afford a game, and we never went to a game. You know, we just couldn't afford it. But he would always say that. When I got drafted to Dallas, and understand now, after all that going through at St. Thomas in school, my mind was made up. I was going to graduate. I went to college back then in 1988 to leave school early, because I left after my junior year of eligibility. You had to graduate early. Now, the thing that gave you was control over the draft. Like, if a team was drafting me, I could tell them, no, I don't want to get drafted by you. And if they did draft me, I could drop a class and go back to school. They would lose a draft choice, and then I can apply for another draft in the supplemental draft. So I had that in my back pocket. So when, like, Green Bay, other teams wanted to call and draft, I was like, no, I'm not very good in the cold weather. You know, but prior to the draft, Jimmy Johnson had talked to me, and Jimmy knew what I was doing. He said, listen, I'm going to help you. I wish you the best. I know you're going. I wish you would stay for your final year, but I know you got some things at home that you need to take care of. He understood. I love Jimmy. And he said, I'm going to give you all the help you could. He said, now, all I'm saying to you is, he said, I know what you're trying to do. But if Dallas draft you, don't try that stuff. And he told me then that he had a billionaire friend that is looking into buying the Dallas Cowboys. Now, every team that was looking at me called me prior to that draft, prior to drafting me. And I'm sitting at home, Green Bay called. We got the whole family. We're the brokest. We were so poor. We were so poor.
You were poor. You were poor.
No, we were poor. I tell people poor. I understand the correct word because I speak for a living is poor. But since we didn't have any money, we couldn't afford the other O and R. We called it poor. We were just poor. We couldn't afford the other O and R. And I'm sitting here doing negotiations with these people. Like, I don't think I'm good in Green Bay. This is seventh pick in the draft. You know, like, but what I thought even then, because my major was business, I said, I may lose something on the front end as far as draft slots go, but if we'll get rid of the right team, personality and all that stuff, and I was studying major in business and minor in communication, I can make that up on the back end, you know, with good tradition and everything. You know, Green Bay has great tradition. So Dallas never even called. I'm sitting home. I was like, man, I thought Dallas was interested. They didn't even call. And then there come Dallas is up next. I'm like, phone never even rung. Nobody's going to call. And then they get right up and drive. I said, oh, my God. You know, for a moment, I thought there's no way I'm going to Dallas because every team knows they have to talk to me. They have to get the okay to draft me. Dallas did not get that okay. So I thought when he went up and called my name, I said, oh, man, Jimmy must have told him. Jimmy must have said something. Don't worry about it. If you drive, Mike will love it. Something. How would they know? Why didn't they call? But they did not call. But when they drafted me, it was the happiest day. It was just the happiest day for my whole family. I mean, we were so happy. And then I came because of the relationship with my father, the days we sat, watched the Dallas Cowboys play, and he wore that fedora hat. And my dad, I lost my dad 3 years before that. When I got here, that's the first thing I said was my new dad was Tom, because it really was my old dad was Tom, and it was my new dad all over again, and it was an incredible moment. Everybody thought, wow, that's going to be a problem for Tom Landry. That kind of kid, that's not what Tom's used to, but they didn't understand the backdrop and the respect that I had and the love I had for Tom Landry and the Dallas Cowboys. That there's no way I would have ever disrespected him.
What was the interaction like between the two of you?
I mean, Tom, yeah, just like anything else. It was like anybody else. I was looking at a god, and so I was like, hey, that's Coach Landry right there. You know?
Did you ever call him Tom?
I've never called him Tom. I've always called him Coach. Now, to be honest. I call Coach Garrett Coach.
Yeah,
you know, just out of it's the position, and it deserves that respect. And if you got any chance at success, it must be given that respect.
Did you ever find out if Jimmy said anything to him?
I did not. I just assumed.
That's the first thing I thought when you were telling this story. Jimmy must have talked to Gil.
Yeah, he had to say something because Gil. Yeah, it just went for it. And then I remember even coming here and reading some of the things. Everybody said, what are you doing? Why would you draft this kid? It's like you talked about earlier. This is the kid. Nobody wants this kid's crazy. He's running out the field, you know. And I remember Tex Schramm saying to people, relax. This kid will accelerate our return to the living. You know, and I remember those exact words. And I carry that every time I worked out. I said, I appreciate him, as we talk about him believing in me, them believing in me. And I worked out with that in mind. This kid will accelerate our return to the living.
And you got hurt that year, too, didn't you?
I got hurt. I got hurt my first 2 years. Ankle, fibula bone, first year, and then second year, tore up my ACL. And it got tough and bleak there for a moment.
When did you know you were going to be okay?
First of all, when I got hurt, my mom came. She moved here. You know, she moved here. She's my wife, and they started taking care of me. And I remember my mom was rubbing my knee, my ACL, and I was so depressed, man. I was depressed because I had never really had a major injury. And I just felt like I felt like it was over. My career was over. And I remember my mom rubbing and she said, "Baby, God, you're going to be okay, baby. You got to have faith. You're going to be okay." And she said, "You're just so worried." She said, "Are we going to be okay, baby?" She said, "I really like where we are. I don't want us to go back to the way we were living." I said, "We're not going back, baby." I said, "We're okay." She said, "Well, what about the football?" I said, "We still get paid this year." She said, "Oh, boy, you good. What you talking about? Boy, y'all make something to eat around here. We still get paid. We good." I said, "We get paid this year. I got to make sure I get back and get healthy and get back out there so we continue to be okay." But the turnaround came, and I'll tell people this, I don't mind, when they brought in Mike Worsick. Mike Worsick, I just think, is the best in the world.
By the way, speaking of then and now, the Cowboys' strength and conditioning.
Six Super Bowl rings he has. You know, we keep talking about Tom Brady and his three. Charles Haley and his five, Tom Brady and his five and Charles Haley and his five. I'm so used to saying I got three. But they got five. He has six. He has six. Not by happenstance either. This man was truly the best, and he was God sent. You know, he was so into the workouts. He spent so much time with me. And he sold me a bill of goods. This is how it came, because I was not coming back well off the knee injury. I had to go in and get it worked on again. And when Mike Worsick came in, I had on a trench coat. I lost so much weight because I couldn't eat. I was depressed. And he said to me, he said, "They don't think you can make it back." He said, "I don't know why you can't." He said, "Man, it takes six units. Six parts of your body you need to run." He said, "Five are working fine." He says, "It takes your two ankles, your knees, and your hips." He said, "Five of the six are fine. And we can rebuild that last, the sixth one. You're going to be fine." And I said, "Oh, man, this man knows something. This knows." And it gave me something. Years later, we were working out. He said to me, "I can't believe you broke that junk I gave you."
He made it up.
Yeah, I said, "What are you talking about, that junk?" He said, "Man, I made that up on the spot." He said, "I can't believe." He said, "You should have seen the light that went on in your eyes when I said that." And I think about that now. You know what that was? That I just needed somebody to believe that I can come out of it, because I didn't believe I can come out of it. And I latched on to it. And Mike and I, we became the best of friends, man, and we worked out all the time together. I mean, he was just great. I remember when I was going through some tough times, and I was going to court for that possession case and all of this, and in court, the people said that the police officer, Johnny, had put a hit out on me. And in the middle of the court, they stopped the court to bring him in and say, "Yeah, we just arrested
Rodriguez?" Was it Johnny Rodriguez? Hernandez.
Johnny Hernandez. Yeah, Johnny Hernandez. I was watching Aaron Hernandez the other day. So you bring that, and that's why it was so fresh in my mind. I was watching the story of Aaron Hernandez. God bless it. But they say, "Yeah, he put a hit out on you, and we wanted to warn you and just let you know. But we arrested him because he did it to an undercover guy. But we don't know how many other people he talked to." So I would have to leave court and go work out with Mike. And of course, Mike heard this, and oh, you think he would just have some kind of sympathy towards me or something? You know, they got Mike. You know, they arrested people to put trying to hire a professional hitman, get me out here. You know, soon as I come out there, we're on the track over at Valley Ranch, and he has the ropes that we do the speed work with, and he tosses them to me. I said, and they follow me. I said, what are you doing? He said, grab those ropes. I said, what are you doing? He said, I don't want to come too close and mistakenly get shot.
That guy might not be a good shot.
I was like, oh, my God. I said, are you joking, man? Come on, man. But it was little things like that that get you over some tough situations, you know. And he was like, come on, man. Let's just we get back to work, man. I just love him, man. We spent a lot of time together, a lot of time. And, you know, we enjoy the same kind of music. You know, the Al Greens, the oldies and goldies, we would make CDs and all of those things together to get back to working out, man. He was God sent, man. It was definitely Mike Worcester that turned it around for me.
We could do this for 3 hours and not crack the surface, but I'm going to try a couple of more. I mentioned that Gilbrandt, Tex Schramm, and Tom Landry were an interesting triumvirate, and they really were respectful of each other's area. Somehow they managed to get through 29, from 60 29. To 89, the three
29.
Of them were together. Yeah.
In this business.
In this day and age, yeah.
In this business.
Right.
Never heard of.
Yeah, exactly. And so to me, that is a significant accomplishment and the only triumvirate in team history that has had to negotiate something reasonably similar would be the triplets. Because you and Troy Aikman and Emmett Smith had to share all of that spotlight. You had to find a way to make that work and coexist, let alone thrive the way you did and have. How'd you do that?
Well, I think order is the best word with it. And it's so funny that I give that and say that because when we go back to what you were talking about, and people say, watch this guy running around in number 47 and how crazy he is and all the guys. That's exactly what they think. This is disorder. Why would I want this? This is disorder. Why is Tom drafting this? This is disorder. But there are people that I'm Jimmy Johnson, Gary Stevens, my coaches that I had in college, and my coach George Smith, who took me out of the ghettos of Fort Lauderdale and brought me into St. Thomas. The one thing they've always taught, if we're going to have success at this game, we have to have order. And you never, ever go after the head coach. And you never, ever go after the quarterback. This is order on the team. This is order. Now, I will sit and say to you that I communicated best with both sides of the football team. Both sides of the football team. I'm talking about black and white sides of the football team. And you have to come together in this sport to do anything great. You can win championships in other sports without a unity. But you cannot do it in football. It is impossible to do it in football. So we have to bring those groups together. And Troy understood that. I understood it. And Emmett understood it. Emmett was just a puppet, a baby. Emmett was just a puppet, a baby who was just bouncing around, you know, just happy to be around. But when Troy was all order, it was all order. And I understood it. And I knew we needed that order. And there was no way that it was ever any issue between Troy Emmett and me. What I tell people all the time, I said, we were able to win 3 Super Bowls, and not one time have you ever heard of any spat between us, you know, between those triplets, you know.
Matter of fact, Troy Aikman was your only teammate to come
right
to court.
The only one that showed up. You never heard any spat between us. Now, that's the reason that happens, because, first of all, you know, when you go through some of the tough times you went through that we went through, we didn't just step in and win championships. We went through the 1-15 and then the 3-13 and the 7-9s. And we remember those team only meetings and still losing games, you know. So we knew that it took all of us and that carried us into the great years. But, man, Troy was an incredible guy, man. He was just an incredible guy, incredible man, so much more mature than all of us. And we needed that. And we gave him that, and he gave us order. It was order. I gave him. He was the guy. When I missed practice, Troy would come to me and say, hey, you know, I need you at practice, even if you're not 100%. Because when you're there, you get guys going. You can say things and do things and get guys going in ways I can't do it. I need you there. No matter where you are, Michael, physical health, I just need you out there riling them up again. I said, I got you, coach. I got you. I got you, buddy.
Last thing about him, because one of my favorite answers to a question I've asked in my whole life was and this was at the very top times, you know, Super Bowls and everything. And I asked you one day in the locker room, can you describe the ball that is coming to you from Troy Aikman? Yeah.
Man, I get on people all the time, and I'm in a position to do it on air. Because on air I get on people and say, man, we don't give Troy the due he's deserved. And, I mean, he's had a great career, and everybody knows, you know, the Cowboys, Dallas Cowboys quarterback, and he's won 3 Super Bowls, all his Hall of Fame, all that. We still don't give him the due that he deserves because of the style of football that we played. These dudes we see now throwing for 1 billion yards, like they throw better than Troy? Are you joking? Troy was a perfect, perfect quarterback. I mean a perfect quarterback. And his balls, when they sizzle, they sizzle. They come through. Yeah, yeah. I'm running slant routes, man. You can hear the ball whistling through as it comes to you. And it just comes and it stops. I says, go ahead and catch me, baby. I'm right here. I said, thank you. You know, that's really how he threw the ball. And I played with guys in the Pro Bowls. You know, I played with the Brett Favre and Steve Youngs and all these guys in the Pro Bowl. And I remember being the Pro Bowl thing. Boy, listen. I mean, they're good. They're good. But they are not. Go ahead and catch me, baby. You know what I mean? They're not that kind of good. Troy was a different dude, man. And I tell you now, I just don't think he gets the credit he deserves for the way he played the game.
And by the way, folks, that's exactly the same answer I got 25 years ago to that same question.
It was the perfect pass. And for our offense, that was needed. I mean, he was just perfect.
Last question. You have made it to 52.
Yeah.
And you've been generous enough to invite us into your home. You're doing okay here.
Yeah.
You're doing all right.
When you, and I always say this, I say I measure men in distance travel. I measure men in distance travel. Don't tell me where you are. Tell me where you started before you tell me where you are, and I shall measure you accordingly.
And that is exactly why we call this then and now.
Yeah.
So you came from then, 17 siblings, 10 years old, and filling up buckets of cement. Yeah. And here you are now. And now you've lived longer than your father lived. So now what?
Yeah. Well, if God has given me this time, and he has given me this time, It's what do I do to give him time? You know, that's what it is. When you accomplish what you accomplish, what I've been blessed enough to accomplish on the football field and in that part of life, and that has fed my family and fueled me and given me an opportunity to do other things and business and everything. But it's what am I giving back? You know, what am I giving back? Think about it now. At 52, I thought at 51, maybe it. At 52, I don't got another 52 to go. Ain't no doubt. Or just when you look at the lifespan of football players, you look at just men in general and what we've gone through and all the things and how things are, there's no way I got another 52. So I got what I have left, and what will I do with it? And this is my, this right now, this is my card on the way out the door. This is what that is. This is my card on the way out the door. What will I leave? Who will I help on my way out? Who am I going to try to get to a better place? And how am I going to serve and be better for God? That's what it's about now. That's what it's about. And I'm okay with that. I have a granddaughter now. A granddaughter. It's the most beautiful thing in the world, man. A granddaughter. Can't wait to get a grandson. I'm going to put him on your baby and read. I'm going to start reading defenses right early. We're going to start figuring this thing out right early. I'm going to be the worst grandfather for a grandson in the world because I'm going to put him right on your baby and read and get him on some football immediately. But yeah, life is good now. Life is good now. But Brad, with that, life is scary. Because I want to just continue to work hard, man. I want to do the right things, and I want to be here for my family. And there's a lot of things going on out here in the world that worries you. And I think very few people talk about the fear of being in the position that we are in. All of us in business, the fear of being in that position and walking around with that fear. And that's why you have to stay close to God and stay prayed up and say, give me strength to keep it moving forward.
God made one of these, Michael Urbans. Thank you for your time.
Man, thank you guys for coming by and spending some time with me at the house over here. I appreciate it.
Then and Now, I'm Brad Sham.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.